Blog Talk Radio.
Our community have become toxic waste. And those in high places are planning to remove the toxic waste. And while we flitter and live this frivolous, foolish life, seeking pleasure from our bodies and pleasure from the bodies of others, and seeking to be famous and wealthy in this world, to be used by the power to make our people think that if you go to school and work hard, you too can be successful. That's a lie. I don't give a damn how many of you go to school and work hard. They select a few out of the mass to deceive the rest that this house is not your house. And you are going to have to think about a house of your own, because white America, listen to me good, cannot support you any longer. White America cannot give jobs to her millions of unemployed, much less out. Did you hear me?
Elijah Muhammad told us in the 60s we should pool our resources and get farmland, because there is no freedom without land. You remember those teachings? He said that the time of separation had come, and that we are going to have to think about building a nation of our own. You, in the 60s, you were ready to say, it's nation time. You don't say that no more. Because you have been deceived into thinking that inclusion into this is your salvation. This that you want to be included in has no future. None.
Greetings and assalamu alaikum. Welcome to tonight's edition of the Time to Leave Blog Talk Radio Show. We are looking forward to a wonderful conversation with the returning guest. I want to get right to the conversation, so I'm going to forego my normal, beautiful, eloquent introduction for our show, and I'm going to introduce our guest. Tonight is Brother Leroy Muhammad. He's been on the show at least two times. He is coming, and the topic of our show is the state of emergency. Could living in separate communities make a difference? And so that's the topic, but we're going to have a broad conversation around the state of what's going on now. We're going to talk about some of the things. We're going to rehash a little bit of Savior's Day. Me and Brother met and talked at Savior's Day. And we're just looking forward to having a real good conversation, and hopefully enlightened conversation. By the way, you know the regular rules. If it's something that you want to question or something you want to say, push the 1 on your dial, and you will get an opportunity to join the conversation or ask a question. So right now, we bring on Brother Leroy.
Alaikum.
Well, alaikum salam, sir. How are you doing?
I'm fine by Allah's grace. I'm just surviving this current situation. How about yourself, dear brother?
Brother, I'm blessed because, one, my family's fine, and two, I feel that I am under protection because I am striving to follow the eating and thinking of the teachings that are taught to us by the Honorable, the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan. How's your family, brother?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. My family is in good spirits. we, you know, like you just mentioned, we all are Muslim, and we've been practicing, you know, by Allah's grace and permission and mercy, we've been practicing for a long time, and so we were kind of psychologically prepared, if nothing else, for a time like this. So we're a tight-knit family, and we're all checking in on each other regularly. So we're doing well. We're doing well, and I pray that's the same for most of the believers, you know, that we are enduring this. If nothing else, you know, Allah has prepared us. You know, we've had very good teaching. So, I pray that is kicking in at this point.
Yes, sir. I pray as well. Yeah, brother, when I landed in Detroit for Savior's Day, I did not have any idea where to eat. And I thought about you. I said, wait a minute. Because we talked about Brother Leroy, and he, you know, gave us information on some of these wonderful places. And so I didn't know where I was, so I called you. And then you basically suggested that we go to explore an area called Hamtramck. And if I recall, that's an area that was at one time depressed and claimed by Bangladeshi Muslims, and is now a thriving community within itself. And I think it would be interesting, this is just what I was thinking, to juxtapose our conversation based on them as a model, not the model, but a model of a community that's controlling themselves. And so when I went there, I saw blocks and blocks and blocks of restaurants, shops, mom and pop shops. I saw cleaners. I saw auto repair places. I saw sewing places. I saw all kinds of shops, hair places, and they were all had Islamic or Bangladeshi names. And so it was just so impressive. And so now with the state of emergency we have going on, I'm thinking, okay, you know, what's the advantage and or disadvantages of them controlling their community like that? And so if you could just kind of give a general talk on, you know, what's going on in Detroit, and then maybe just saying, okay, this is what may or may be going on, or if you know firsthand what's going on with that community in Hamtramck.
Okay, yes, sir. Well, I'll say this. You know, I'll start off kind of with the last part, and then I'll work my way back. Detroit is in the center of the national news right now because, you know, in Detroit just seems, we always seem to find ourselves right here. And that's because outside of the East Coast, Detroit is the highest concentrated number of people that are, you know, confirmed to be infected with COVID-19. And that's amazing. You know, we're higher than Texas, than places in L.A. You know, it's Detroit. And so one of the things that, you know, the reasons that is being pointed to is something that they're calling concentrated poverty. So this condition that we're going through seems to have, you know, it seems to discriminate towards impoverished communities. So Detroit has a lot of black people, and we're all close together. One of the things that we talked about in the past about Detroit is that we are a very residential city. We have a lot of houses, and there's a lot of abandonment, but we still have a relatively densely populated neighborhoods. So the infection and the deaths are mounting here. The other thing is that the people of the city of Detroit don't seem to maybe we aren't reacting like people may think we should. You know, if you were to come to Detroit, you might see a lot of the regular day-to-day activity here that you would see on any other day, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's something to say positive about that because we don't necessarily rely on outside people to tell us what to do and when to do it. But the negative part of that that's impacting us is this happens to be a very serious issue. And this may not be one of the times where our rebelliousness is going to be in our favor. So we're suffering. You know, the hospitals, you know, I was just reading a story about one of the major hospitals that's right in the center of the city where the nurses staged a sit-in. They just stopped working. This hospital, Sinai Grace, already is just, I mean, they should have a reality TV show at this hospital. And it's part of the main Detroit Medical Center. But it's just always a circus there. But now, you know, they have patients that are dying in the hallways. It's just a zoo. And so, and that's mostly us that are dying in those places. So we really have to get a grip on it now. Detroit is unique, and we've talked about this in the past, because we're surrounded by independent communities. And, you know, I know there are places all over the country that have different populations. Maybe they have Latino population and Arab population and, you know, East Indian populations. But we have those populations that are very united. And when you come here, you may think that you're almost visiting foreign countries because they really claim their communities that powerfully.
Yes, sir.
So Hamtramck is one of those places. So Hamtramck is pretty much composed of three main populations. You have the Bengali people from Bangladesh, and you have the people from Yemen, which are Muslims from Arabia, and then you have a good number of people from Poland in Hamtramck.
Wow.
And when you go there, you know, they're extremely united. And so one of the reasons why that's significant and it's important right now is because they have control over their own destiny. Their people can rely on one another as it relates to receiving aid, receiving medical attention. And because they're united, they have their own best interests at heart. So they don't have to have the same amount of apprehension about going to see a doctor that we do, because we don't know what may happen to us at a hospital right now. So that's one of the key points of why the unity right now is so important, because we don't have our own fate in our hands today. Our fate is in the hands of people that have never looked out for us. But we just don't have the means to do it for ourselves today. And this we don't have any choice. Either you feel sick and you go see your enemy, or you do nothing. And we have to change that going forward. So I think, you know, hopefully that kind of covered everything in the question. And, you know, I have a lot of passion about that particular subject because I'm personally a high risk myself. I'm a lifelong asthmatic, and you know, I'm fearful right now because I don't think there's no circumstance that would make me go see a doctor right now.
Mm. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I hear what you're saying, brother, especially, you know, under the circumstances and environment. And so I love what you said about them. One of the advantages about being in your own community is that you have your own resources that you can trust. One of the things that I imagine in black communities is that a lot of times you can't even trust your own neighbor. You know, when things get rough, things get bad, you might have a neighbor next to you that may, you know, want to rob you or might want to, you know, see what you have. But this, having your own community like that, these are people and their culture's tied. Their children grow up together. They hire each other's children, and then they marry into each other's family.
Absolutely.
So I look at this and say, at a time like this, it could be, you know, real tight. So, but still, health-wise, I'm sure they're feeling the strain. But it's better to feel the strain with people that you know and love than with strangers.
Right, absolutely. And you feel that strain, but you know that the doctor that you're going to see is truly intending to save you. You know, right now, people have heard this all over the country that, you know, and it's true. It may not be as dramatic as people make it to be, in the sense of, you know, there's only so many ventilators and some people are being taken off so other people can live. Well, you can look at it like this. With limited resources in a pandemic, the resources are going to go to the communities where the people feel emotionally tied to. So in hospitals in the inner city, you know, how many, they said that, I think I read one report that one hospital, Henry Ford Hospital, had 60 infected staff people. So you go to work, and almost all of the patients in the emergency room are poor black people. And you're going to risk your life, not just your life, you're going to risk your family life because you have to go home to your family to try to save people that you don't respect. So how much effort are you going to put into that? You know, and of course it's your job, and I think that that probably is more of a motivator than trying to save people. It's just I don't want to lose my job, so I have to go to work. I have to serve, but there are people who are walking away from their jobs right now because it's just they just don't care enough their life. Now, if you look at other communities, that is intrinsic. They have to save one another because the doctors in the Bengali community or the doctors in the Arab community, they became doctors to save their own people. Mm-hmm. And so this moment, it's the time for them to feel, you know, the need, and there's the impetus there. They're driven to save, whereas the opposite is true for us. Now, we do have black doctors. We have black doctors.
Right.
But most of the time, because we don't have a united, centralized community way of thinking about ourselves, that person may be thinking as an individual instead of thinking as a community. And still, so we still may not get the benefit of someone who cares enough to go above and beyond. So that's some of the concerns. I mean, I believe that eventually, you know, Allah is God, and we belong to Him. So I do believe that Allah isn't going to just watch us fall over a cliff, but I do believe that Allah will allow us to experience some of the pain in this moment so that when we get an opportunity, we'll do something better afterward. So I'm hopeful that that's the way we'll react, because I think in the coming days we're going to come to understand how little concern these people really have for us, and especially in Detroit.
Wow. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. You touched on something that I want to talk about as we go forward, and you know, near the end of the conversation, we'll talk about that. What, you know, are we to learn from this, and what can we do? How should we plan, and what should we be doing going forward? But before we go to that, I wanted to ask, we've been talking mainly about the benefits of being in a community or being a strong in the community, mainly around healthcare. But the whole life of the community is affected not only by the health care,
right,
and having your own doctors, but it's also affected by the political power that a tight community wields, the economy that a tight community wields, and even on down to the security that a tight community wields. And so as this goes forward, and Allah willing, as this starts to dwindle down, how would a community like a Hamtramck, or it could be an Asian community or a Latino community that's tight, how would they fare better than us as black people, where we don't have the proper political power, we don't have the proper control or representation of our economy, and we definitely don't control our security?
Well, right before this call, after the call tonight, I was actually on a Zoom video conference with the NAACP leadership in Detroit, and they were talking about how, because there's a completely different side of this story, which is the economic devastation the entire country is seeing as a result of the, you know, shelter in place or stay at home order. Federal money, over $2 trillion, is already earmarked to hit, you know, the whether it's small business or individuals. This money, there's a level of sophistication that you have to have in order to get it. Okay, so there millions of applications are going in for the money through the SBA and different agencies, whether it's at a federal, state, or even local level. If you have a united community, you have a united body of people that are passing information back and forth to each other to ensure that their whole group gets in the door. they can all take advantage of that together. That's what the attempt of this video conference was to help black people, black businesses, get on board. But see, we had to wait till after the fact in order to try to react to this. And so that means, you know, one of the things that one of the speakers was saying was Dr. Wendell Anthony. He was talking about how so many black businesses aren't even qualified to even approach the bank for the money. So when all of this smoke clears and this money is distributed, it's going to be distributed to people who were united and prepared to help one another up. That's
wow.
I commend them for trying to help us, but we're right in the midst. The applications, it's time to fill them out. And what they're saying is, you have to. So one of the black owned banks, First Independence Bank, the president of the bank was also on the call. He was on the Zoom call, and he was basically saying, if you don't have a business account with our bank already, there's really not much we can do for you on the first round of funding because it's required that we had an existing relationship with you. So we didn't have a relationship with you already. Now that the funding is going to come through, we can't help you at this point. But we do advise, the bank manager was saying, or the president was saying, that we do advise you to come open up an account. So maybe funding that's coming down the line later, you can take advantage of it. But you can't really do much now because we weren't in position. You know, we're taught in the nation, you know, that we have to qualify ourselves for positions that await us. So, you know, it's positioning is critical. And we're not, as a group, in position. See, these people, they saw this money coming, and they united so that they would be in position. So we always wonder how all of the gas stations or the mm-hmm. nail salons or the beauty supply places are owned by people other than us. That's because they didn't go after the opportunity alone. They went as an entire community, a united group of people. We go after those things alone. You know, and so that's one of the problems that we're having. And so I don't want to just sound, you know, I'm upset. We're in the middle of a crisis at this, and this is one of the worst times to try to react to something is when you're right in the middle of it. And I just pray for
you
going forward, we won't allow that to continue next time.
Yeah, you know, brother, as you speak, I'm thinking about, you know, leadership, you know, and the NAACP, may Allah bless them. They've had some good people to do some good things, but they've also, you know, fallen short, and they weren't made, they really weren't formed to be service, true service to black people. They were just a buffer between the beneficent Jewish people that didn't want us to have the economy from the first place. So when the NAACP tried to do economic things, it's really going against the foundation of their founding. So when I look at this and hear this, then the responsibility falls on those who have the most knowledge and the most ability.
Yes.
And that's us, you know, the Muslims.
Absolutely.
You know, we know these things. We know who our enemy is. We know what our enemy's plans are. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, I would like to see, and I'm jumping the gun now. I'm jumping the gun, but this is my response to what you said. You know, I would like to see us be proactive because, you know, this is a time really for those of us who are not, you know, recovering and those of us who have health and ability to make plans, to plan what we
yep.
should be doing with and for our people to control our communities. And I don't know if that's happening. I don't know if those conversations are taking place. I don't know if people are saying, look, we need to build some, you know, within the ministries, we need to build some coalitions, and we need to start putting some things in place, you know. And I would, if this happens because of this virus, I would say that's one of the, what they call a silver lining. If we are, if the Muslims say, okay, we're in a situation where we can't sell papers, which is our gross national product. You know, having learned from this, are we going to come out of this, you know, being the same, say, oh, we can sell papers now, and not plan for another way to keep us going? You know, this community base. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely. Yes, sir. I mean, brother, that's 100% correct. The separation conference that Student Minister Abel held in Detroit during Savior's Day, absolutely interesting. Because, one, I was here. and there wasn't a major push to, for people to be in attendance. It was, you know, one of the conferences here, but it was packed out the door. When I went, it was a lot of believers, but there was a lot of lost rounds, and there was a lot of people who came desperately wanting to hear something because they want to see the Nation of Islam lead this conversation.
Yes, sir.
We, the Nation has had way more success. I mean, we're heads and shoulders above everyone else when it comes down to organizing black people and getting us to move collectively. Allah put us in the driver's seat in that regard. And so I think that if anybody is going to do it, it has to be us. We have to do it because we don't have necessarily a track record of having our self-interest out front. And we're not easily bought off. So the Nation has to do it. It's our responsibility to organize our people. And I believe that if this were to get any worse, the people would just start showing up at our door because they don't have anything else and nowhere else to go. So I think that black people are starting to understand that they belong to us. And even though they were being rebellious by not coming along with us, I think that they know that we're the only real voice for them in the world today. That's what I believe, Brother Carlton. And I think that I think that can be proven. So
yes, sir. That's it. Well, I want to let our audience know, brother, you're uniquely qualified to make those comments and to talk about this because you grew up in a time, in a separate society. There was a Muslim society in Detroit prior to 1975, and I remember you sharing that you went to Muslim schools, then you worked with some jobs, and you really didn't know life outside the community. So what I'm going to do this, I want to talk about that, and then I want to get into a little bit of the quote-unquote controversial things that might be coming down the pipe. You know, they're talking about these vaccinations, and they're talking about how this might be government mandated, and us not having control of communities, what kind of things we have to deal with, and what can we hope to, how can we hope to avoid that. But before we do that, we have a caller. So I'm going to let our caller get on. So we have caller with the last four digits, 0613. What's your name and where are you calling from?
This is Craig Muhammad. My name is Craig Muhammad. I'm coming from Detroit, Michigan, myself. And I have
praise be to Allah.
Praise be to Allah. Walaikum salam. I was listening to you and my dear brother Leroy, explain the plight we have, the fight that we have as black people in the different concept. See, when I looked at separation, I always believed by the Most Honorable Elijah Muhammad, he was saying that separation was the nation putting itself determination. As my brother beautifully pointed out, Brother Leroy, he pointed out that my interpretation, the need for separation just for our survival, lost just in the committee. Where we have people go to medical school and contribute to the community in a sense that it's not financial for them. It's a sense of duty that they are there to save their people in the profession that they're in. And this was one of the greatest. This was really a kickoff from the Million Man March when Honorable Louis Farrakhan had explained that black people should go back to the communities and join some organizations. This was spearhead into that type of organized community that is separate, not in a negative way. Like right now we're separate, but we're separate negatively, you know, as relates to it's not beneficial to us, but we have to get our community separated. Sense of it's a self-separation. It's a sense of self-survival and also self-identity. And so, as we see ourselves in a dilemma, like in a in circumvents will go to hospitals and see that, you know, most of the virus is attacking the southeastern Michigan, which is Detroit, Metro Detroit. You know, there's very few states, you know, anywhere towards of
I'm having a little trouble hearing you, brother. Brother Craig. A little trouble.
You having trouble hearing me? Can you hear me now?
Yes, sir. And if you can wrap it up in a few minutes.
Okay. Well, you have most cases that's in the southeastern part of Michigan, which is Detroit, Metro Detroit, and we see ourselves in a situation where we have to really depend on ourselves. You can't go and get black people are making where everybody is making their own different things to cover their mouth and survive and different things to keep themselves from catching the virus. But we're still catching the virus in numerous ways and dying in numerous ways. You know, and my wife and her job, she have a job where seven people already had died. So it's attacking us and attacking our community. And we're dealing with a government that's really not focused on concentrating where the effort should be concentrated at, where as it relates
that's
to
right,
supplies,
that's right.
where as it relates to the different things that we might need, you know.
Yes, sir.
So,
well, we're
going to
go on.
No.
We appreciate your comment, Brother Craig.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to go ahead and open
sir.
Up the lines, make sure everybody has a chance to comment, and we appreciate your call so you can keep listening, and we're going to go on back to Brother Leroy right now. Thank you, Brother Craig.
Yes, sir.
Brother Leroy, you have any comments on Brother Craig's statements?
Yes, sir. I mean, I think Brother Craig is absolutely correct. Brother Craig and I both, you know, we both have soldiered in the nation, starting all the way back in '89, and we've seen a lot. And I know that what he said about the minister asking us, especially those that were in college, because Brother Craig and I, we were college students together as well. And, you know, we had a desire, and still do, but to bring whatever education we were receiving back to our communities. And let's say it like this, Brother. I mean, I know there's a word, community, and we can put quotations around it because some people and it is true that our community does mean the greater black community as we currently geographically sit, you know, in our houses, you know, in our cities. But there's also the more intimate community that we are required to build, which is where we are geographically centralized, where we are together and we form a dense community of Muslims and people who want to be under the leadership and guidance of the Muslims. So, and that desire for us to come back to those communities is both, to come back to the existing communities and then to come back and help build the communities that I think that Allah intended for us to have. So I agree with Brother Craig on that, you know, and I would say that I think that we need to maybe bring that back to the forefront.
Mm, yes, sir. Yes, sir. How would you see us doing that, bringing it to the forefront?
I would say, you know, I was talking to one of my brothers today and about how Allah promised at the end how he was going to force us to separate. You know, I remember a quote where the Honorable Elijah Muhammad said something similar to, he said, my faith is going to force your faith, meaning my faith in Allah is not going to fail, and Allah is going to force you to separate. And I think right now the conditions that we're suffering are going to force us to look inward. And so once we start looking inward, I think that'll make the job of separating easier. And I think that bringing it back to the forefront means that some of us maybe have to go out into a vanguard position and demonstrate the success of separation, even if at a very micro, you know, it could be atomic scale, where we are really small businesses, maybe a shop, a barbershop, a restaurant, a bakery, where we go in and we start bringing and raising the Nation of Islam's brand up, and then we start building communities around those spaces. That's the way everybody else does it. You know, I'll say this very quickly about the formation of Dearborn, Michigan, where a lot of Muslims are, and the formation of Hamtramck. Believe it or not, those places began with just a simple shop. If you go into most of these places, you'll find, you know, that they have these old small restaurants and maybe a little coffee house or a tea shop or some type of spice shop or a bakery. And they'll set it up, and then their own patriots, their people who see the world the way they see it, they'll come there and they'll sit at small tables and they'll talk. And then eventually, as that place becomes busy with activity, one of the brothers or sisters in the spot will say, you know what, there's a lot of us all concentrating in this one little spot. We need a second one. And then they branch off, and then the area starts taking on an identity. People start referencing that area as where you go if you want to engage that specific population. So if it was us, there would be a place. People would say, well, if you want to go see the Muslims, you go here. And that's what people will start, they'll gravitate towards that area. It can be just that simple, because that's what was successful prior to 1975. What made my neighborhood a Muslim neighborhood was the mosque, for sure. But it was also all of the small businesses that lined Linwood Avenue at that time. So we had fish markets. We had a small grocery store. We had an ice cream parlor. We had restaurants. We had clothing stores. We had an apartment building. And all of those things kind of just started forming. And unfortunately, the Nation of Islam was sprouting in that way, and it started sprouting more like that in the 70s. So as it was reaching its real momentum, the nation fell. And I believe had the nation not fallen, we probably would have taken that entire area over, and we would have had a Nation of Islam Hamtramck by now. But I'm sure we would have, because we were moving fast, you know, because that wasn't the only commercial strip. That wasn't the only commercial district. Not only that, the believers were buying the houses. So my family, my father bought a house on right in that neighborhood. And my secretary, Brother Kenneth, one of the my secretaries, my had several secretaries back then, one of the my secretaries, he bought a house right behind our house on the next block of Boston Street. And Minister John Muhammad, he and his family, they lived right on the next block on the same street, Chicago Boulevard. They lived right down there. So we were buying up the houses and the businesses. And it just happened just like that. So, you know, we decided that this is the space we're going to dwell in, and we started creating a community. So I think the same thing can happen now. It has to happen now, but maybe a little bit more intentional this time. We may have to plan it out.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Man, that's totally inspiring. Brothers and sisters, we're hearing about existing communities. We're hearing our brother talk about how he grew up and the community he grew up in. Aren't you inspired? You know, we should take this time, the weeks that we may have at home, to, you know, just us and our computers and our televisions and our books and our materials. We should be trying to see how we can build our own communities or control the communities that we're in, or if you can't control the community you're currently in, is it time for you to move to one? Is it time to move someplace where you can't control it? So bringing up moving to a community, one of the things that's being out there is that in different news sections, even in mainstream news, is that measures are going to be put in place by the federal and local governments, similar to some of the measures they have in place regarding the MMR vaccines. And I know in California, they removed the exemption for private schools on religious exemptions. You have to get the MMR, mumps, measles, and rubella vaccine for your children. They're talking about doing that for COVID-19, you know, and so they're showing commercials and they're showing countries that are saying that they are forcing people possibly, or in other countries they're planning to force people to do it by police at gunpoint if you choose not to. Do you see this, a possibility of this happening? And if this happens, could this be the impetus for us to start getting to and migrating into our own communities?
Well, I think that that's a very important question, brother. I was also reading something about that today, and I think I watched a presentation about it. One of the things that's interesting is they're saying that, the, you know, we hear about the flattening of the curve, of spike in cases and how to flatten it. Well, it's interesting that they're saying that, well, it may be starting to flatten a little bit, but the way it's flattening is the stay-at-home orders, the shelter-in-place. So, of course, if everybody stays away from each other, that curve starts flattening. But eventually, they have to let the people back out the house. So, because one curve is flattening, which is the number of COVID cases, but there's another curve, which is economic devastation that's growing. And so you have to let people out the house so they can go to work. You know, it's a lot of different areas that people, of course, everybody loves the fact that they don't have to worry about their utilities being shut off right now, because I'm not sure how it is in other parts of the country, but the light and gas companies, the water companies, if your water was off in the city of Detroit and you were too poor to have it turned back on, one of the first reactions was they went around and turned everybody's water back on. So now all of this stuff is going. So you're basically living in your house. You know, you don't have too many needs besides going and buying food, and gas is only $1.20 a gallon, so you're not really going nowhere, so
right.
You know, it's not that bad on you right now. Well, but that can only last for so long because somebody's carrying that weight for you, and they're not happy to carry it. So what happens is that eventually, so here's the philosophy. Well, what we're going to do is we're going to leave everybody in their houses, and then we're going to go and test, mandatory testing by household. The healthy people can leave. The people that are not healthy have to come with us. At first, I didn't believe it until I heard it from a very good source. So what they're going to do is they're going to do forced quarantine. They're going to say all of the people in your household are okay, but this child is infected. And we need to ask you to allow us to take the child with us, and the rest of you all can go back about your normal life. Now, what's the big problem about that is not only a forced vaccination in that scenario, but also your family cannot come with you when you're quarantined. That's part of being quarantined. So you're going to take people out of their households, and their family will not be able to monitor whatever's happening to you in that scenario. Something like that is going to have to happen. This world is going to have to figure out some type of way to reestablish normalization while also protecting itself away from spiking that curve back up. Because if they say, well, the curve is flattening, so it's okay for everybody to go out, and as soon as everybody goes back out into the public, if that spike starts rising again, they're going to say back into the houses again. One way or another, that's a catch-22. So there has to be a solution, and the solution, I believe, is going to be forced quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not an expert,
basically,
Mr. Carlson, but I'm just
you're observant, and you have experience, and so that's what we want. This is a show where we invite guests to share information based on their experience and their knowledge and assessments of the situation. Speaking of that, we have a caller, and we're going to let our caller express their knowledge on the situation. Caller with the last four digits, 7359. What's your name, and where are you calling from?
Assalamu alaikum. This is Sister Niambe Muhammad calling from Georgia.
Alaikum salam.
Alaikum salam.
I actually wanted to make a comment in accord with what you all were just discussing. There was a Frontline documentary or Frontline episode on this past Tuesday, and it was about the Uyghur Muslims in China, in Xinjiang, China. And they are viewed by China as militant Muslims. They're accused of acts of terror in China. And they have built internment camps and are allegedly or have allegedly imprisoned millions of Chinese Muslims. And one of the things that was most interesting, though, is in one part of this particular part of this episode, they talked about how, on the one hand, when entering a checkpoint, some Chinese were just allowed to go straight through the checkpoint. The other, the Uyghur Muslims, had to take off their shoes. They had to be checked thoroughly. And if they refused, they were in prison. If they refused to check, they were in prison. And then at another point, they talked about the mass surveillance, which they call Leon. Mm-hmm. And when they talked about this mass surveillance that they call Leon, they showed a 5G tower. And so I thought that, that was pretty interesting. But I just saw that that particular, and it just came on this past Tuesday. So if you want to research it and see if you can catch it or if you have a DVR or something, maybe you can watch it. And anyone who might want to do research on the Uyghur Muslims, they're spelled U-I-G-H-U-R-S. But this particular episode of Frontline was just very revealing for me.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, there's been articles, you know, in the Final Call, and did that Frontline article or segment, did it inform you where they got their technology from?
I do not recall seeing that. No, sir.
The software that's driving their surveillance system is from the U.S. The infrastructure, the 5G infrastructure, is Chinese. But the software, which runs the whole thing, is from here. So it's interesting. It's really good. And Tom, did you bring that up, Sitanyam? Because what we see happening overseas, and in general what the American companies do, they get their software and weapons to other companies so they can see how it works. And if also what you've seen in the news is that the Chinese are monitoring, if they're crediting the control of coronavirus with the technology too, because they have apps and they have on their smartphones, and they are actually monitoring people who, and labeling people, just like what you were saying, believe, or they're labeling people who are COVID-19 free and who are not. So that's very timely information that you're sharing with us, Sitanyambi.
And
it
is. Everything that you're saying is right in exact for the call. And another thing that they mentioned, which is going on in America, is that they surveil their phone conversations. And when certain language is used, that triggers the phone surveillance.
Mm-hmm.
So a woman went to visit her family. She was from Kazakhstan. She went to visit her family in China. And because she was a Muslim, a Uyghur Muslim, they imprisoned her, and so she's been separated from her husband and children ever since, and she simply went to go visit her family. So.
Oh, wow. Well, that's very noteworthy. Thank you very much for sharing that with us, Sitanyambi.
Yes, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Yes, Sitanyambi is one of our Time to Leave panelists. So it's interesting, you know, as black people, we get excited about the technology and the gadgets and, you know, and we get these things. But, you know, this technology is not being rolled out for our convenience and our novelty, but it's being rolled out for our, you know, our surveillance and to pacify and monitor us. So any comments, Brother Leroy?
Well, I would say that, you know, another interesting thing kind of tied to it is the fact that you did see this story kind of come out at the same time as the Chinese were making progress with their 5G technology. And I think that, you know, a lot of people are looking at the conspiracy side of this. And I will say this, kind of going back to a previous point, right now in the news, and one of the brothers, I was hoping he was going to call in,
pointed something out to me, and I thought it was a very good point, which is right now we hear that the number of cases, the new COVID cases, you know, and it's starting to spike in the black community. And there's an outcry right now because people are saying, well, this is impacting the black community now, and this is, you know, there's an economic disparity side of this whole story. Well, there's also the side of the story where some people are leading the testing of new treatments on poor people. And there was a few African nations that came out and told the world, don't come to Africa with these new treatments, with this new technology. Whatever you all have to test it on us as guinea pigs, we are not the world's guinea pigs. And so one of the issues that we have is now there's this complaint about how it's impacting black people, how it's impacting Detroiters, how it's impacting poor communities, and it's opening up the door for them to say, okay, fine, we'll give you all the attention that you're begging us for by coming in and bringing all of this new treatments and these things that we have no idea what the impact of those things are going to be down the line. They're going to test on us. So it's so many angles to this, which goes right back to the idea of why we need to have our own community, because we have to think like this, because we've been the victim of every type of plan that has ever been hatched in the last 6,000 years. So no matter what it is, we are afraid that we're going to fall victim to it. And that's pretty much true, because our fate is not in our own hands, going back to the idea of separation. We wouldn't have to worry about that if our own doctors were our primary care providers. We wouldn't have that as a concern, because I wouldn't be worried to go see my brother or sister, because I would know that they would vet out most of what's going on. But we're just not sophisticated enough in all of these areas to speak to what's really going on. And it's difficult to try to figure out in the middle of a crisis. So that's kind of what my take is.
Thank you, brother. We're down to the last 8 minutes or so. And so now I think it might be a good time for this last question if we can go out in this discussion. So as I referenced earlier, this is a time for some of us to reflect, to evaluate, and to plan, regear, you know, or even prepare for this new physical and economic reality coming out of this COVID-19. What should we be doing generally as individuals, but particularly as Muslim followers of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad and the Honorable Minister Louis Farrakhan, knowing what we know, knowing who we're dealing with, what can you recommend for us to do to prepare for us to come out of this better and stronger, and prepare for anything else that might be coming down the pipe?
Well, I can say as a business person, you know, and I did want to mention that some of my insight is based on the business that I operate in, being in real estate, investing in property management. I get to see some of this stuff from an economic side. I will say that our accountants in the Nation of Islam really need to step out front right now. There are a lot of businesses that we run, and we have legitimate business. One of the biggest impacts that, you know, that this country is facing and the world is facing is the economic fallout from everybody staying at home. And so the response, all of this money that's coming out, once again, like I said earlier, is going to fall into the hands of people that are prepared to receive it. A lot of black businesses, we operate in the shadows. And if you're in the shadows, you won't be able to take advantage of the opportunity, because even while you are part of the economy, you don't have the means if you don't have any tax returns filed. You don't have a tax ID number. You don't have a bank account. So what we need is our Nation of Islam accountants. And I know it's a lot of people. The nation has some of everybody. But we need our accountants to step out so that people can, because it's difficult to trust someone with the idea that you've been in the shadows. So you need someone that you feel that you can have, you know, professional client confidentiality agreements with. And so if we had accountants we can go to, a lot of those small businesses, even micro businesses, because some of those benefits are going to 1099 workers, meaning you could be a gig economy worker. You can drive Uber or Lyft or Grubhub or DoorDash. You can be a barber. You can be anything. As long as you have an income, some of the money is earmarked for you, and a lot of it is not just some of it is loans. So the federal government is loaning this money, and like some of it is amortized over 30 years, meaning it's going to be like a 2.75, I think they said, percent interest. So it's going to be a really soft loan, but also a lot of it is going to be forgivable, meaning there's going to be money they're going to give you, and you don't have to pay it back. So the believers need to be in position to take advantage of that. But in order to do it, you need professional help. You should have some professional guidance, because it's also a way for, you know, people that want to go after the loans and some of the other relief, financial economic relief. When you come, you may come out of the shadows, and then once you're out the shadows, you're out the shadows. It's going to be hard to go back into the shadows afterward. And so you need help with doing it the right way. So I would advise anybody that's in business that, you know, because at this point, this condition may be a permanent structural change in how this world does business. And if it is, for years to come, you may have to have some of this money in your account. You may need it. You may not be able to survive without it. So you have to figure out a way to get in line for it. So I would say we need our accountants, we need our attorneys in the nation to step up so people can kind of interface with them, and then we can go together as a group and go take advantage of some of this stuff. I think that's just as important as anything else we could be talking about.
Wow, that's very insightful. Brothers and sisters, if you have any questions or comments, we're down to the last few minutes. Wow, yes, sir. Yes, sir. That's deep. I agree with that 100%, brother, and it's a responsible position. You know, you're right. A lot of us, you know, we hustle. In the nation, we hustle. You know, we don't trust the devil. So a lot of us have, you know, the hustle gig economy, and we won't be able to take advantage of that. And you can only do so much staying in the shadows. Eventually, if you really want to grow, you want to be in a position where you can hire other people, where you can invest this together, where you want to start, you know, companies and corporations or investment teams. You have to come out, and I see that the only way that we can really get back to and exceed our former greatness of controlling communities. So, go ahead.
Well, I wanted to just add this quickly. Philosophically, a lot of people may think, well, you know, I like doing business the way I'm doing it. Well, if we're moving into a different economy, and we're talking about separation, we're going to have a legitimate stance in order to engage outside communities, because the Nation of Islam, we pledge to do international trade and commerce. You can't do international trade and commerce from in the shadows. So we're going to have to step up and become legitimate business one way or the other. So it's just time to do it. One of the big things about it is right now it's an opportunity to do it with probably less penalty than any other time that this generation will ever see, if as long as this world stands. If you're going to do it now, because everybody is doing it now. So do it now. You know. So that's what I would say. And then after this all clears, If you don't even have to be 100% legitimate, as long as you're proving that you're trying to engage the process of bringing your business online, then you're good. So they're also doing deferrals. So the IRS is deferring people that owe taxes. They're doing tax deferrals, meaning you can owe up to $1 million in taxes and back taxes, and they'll defer it. They'll push it off for now and say, we'll worry about that later. Let's just get today taken care of. That's the best position that you can want to be in if you're trying to legitimize your company. So I would advise anybody to do it. But like I said, I think that it should be done under the guidance of, you know, accounting professionals, attorneys, so that you do it right.
Man, there you go, brothers and sisters. Free advice. And I know there's brothers and sisters out there that's going to follow up and take that advice. But, brother, we are at the end of our show. Once again, it's been an exciting, informative show, as usual. And it was a quick hour, so you know, whenever you want to talk again, we could do a follow-up on that based on what goes on. Praise be to Allah. And, brother, we are going to pray that, you know, that all of us, and, you know, Allah's got our security, brother. So don't worry about, you know, this silly disease, because it is something that it's been ordained and allowed by Allah, and He has got the believers in His bosom. So, brother, thank you very much for taking the time to be on the show, and I look forward to talking to you again. And Allah willing, we'll be able to do some things in the very near future.
Absolutely, yes, sir, brother. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam.
Won't you let me? Won't you help me? Won't you help me understand you?
Lord, I've really been real stressed, down and out, losing ground. Although I am black and brown, problems got me pessimistic. Brothers and sisters keep messing up. Why does it have to be so damn tough? I don't know where I can go to let these ghosts out of my skull. My grandma passed, my brother's gone.
Alone.
I never at once felt so alone.
Alone.
I know you're supposed to be my steering wheel, not just my fifth tire.